It's May the 8th, and we are in Parshas Ekev. We are on page 988. That is Perek Tes, chapter 9. We're going to start from Pasuk Chaf Hey, verse 25. Moshe Rabbeinu has just gone through with the Jewish people the fact that they had committed the Avera of the Egel Hazav, of the golden calf, and he had gone through some of the other things they had done wrong as well. So, now we know that Moshe Rabbeinu davened for us, and we were not killed. So, that is the part of the story that Moshe Rabbeinu is up to. So, Pasuk Chaf Hey, verse 25, Vo'esna pal lifnei Hashem, and I supplicated before Hashem, Es arboim hayom ves arboim halayla, the 40 days and the 40 nights, Asher isna palti, that I supplicated, Ki amar Hashem la'ashmid eschem, for Hashem had said that He would destroy you. Vo'espalel el Hashem va'omar, I davened to Hashem, and I said, Hashem Elokim, al tashches amcha v'nachal asecha, do not destroy your nation and
it's his heritage.
Heritage, okay. Asher padisa begodlecha, then you redeemed with your greatness. Asher utseisa mimitzrayim biyad chazaka, that you took out of Mitzrayim with a strong hand. Zechor la'avodecha le'avraham le'yitzchak u'le'yakov, remember your servants, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Al tefen al kishiha am hazev el risho ve'al chatoso, do not turn to the stubbornness of this nation, to its evilness and its sins. Pen yomru ha'aretz asher utseisanu misham, lest the land that you took us out from there will say, mi b'li'ach oles Hashem la'haviyam el ha'aretz asher diber lohem, Hashem did not have the ability to bring them into the land that He's told them He would bring them to. Umisina so sum, and because of His hatred for them, Hotziam, He took them out. Lahamisam bamidbar, to kill them in the wilderness. They will create a narrative. They will say, Hashem never had the ability to bring them into Eretz Yisrael. And therefore, why did He take them out of Egypt, knowing that He could not bring them into Eretz Yisrael? He did it because He hated them and He wanted to destroy them. V'heim amcha v'nachal asecha, but they are your nation and your heritage. Asher utseisa v'chokacha agadol, that you took out with your great strength. Uvizracha netuyam, with your outstretched arm. So Moshe Rabbeinu davens that Hashem should not destroy the Jewish people, essentially to preserve Hashem's reputation. Because if Hashem will destroy the Jewish people after having taken us out of Mitzrayim, then the narrative that the Egyptians will create is that Hashem had the strength to take them out, but did not have the strength to bring them into Eretz Yisrael. And He knew this all along. It's rather than them saying He didn't realize, but that He knew that all along, and because He hated the Jews, He took them out with intention to destroy them. And that's why He took them out. That's the narrative that the Egyptians will create. And in order to avoid that narrative, you should not destroy the Jews. Now, this argument that Hashem should treat us well because of what will be with Hashem's reputation if He doesn't treat us well is an argument that you find in other places. Yechezkel uses that argument as well. Others use the argument in other places in the Chumash, other places in Tanakh. And when you read about these sorts of arguments, they don't feel good because Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't say you should treat the Jews well because you love them, because they're special, because you have great mercy, but rather because you have to preserve your reputation. So that doesn't feel very good to be spared because of Hashem should not ruin His reputation. So, obviously we have to understand that, but before we understand that, let's understand something else. Hashem was prepared to destroy the Jewish people for our Avera. It's Moshe Rabbeinu who points out to Hashem what will happen to Hashem's reputation. That means Hashem didn't care about his own reputation. He was prepared to destroy us because we had sinned, and this sin deserved destruction. So why does Moshe Rabbeinu need, why does Hashem need Moshe Rabbeinu to remind him, so to speak, that his reputation is at stake? First of all, what's so important about Hashem's reputation? And second of all, why does Moshe Rabbeinu need to remind Hashem, so to speak, about that reputation? So Hashem didn't know about that? Of course he knew about that. But whatever is lost in the hurting of Hashem's reputation, apparently that was not enough to tip the scales that Hashem shouldn't destroy the Jews. See, this is really, what I'm asking is really the same question you can ask in any time somebody davens. Then you could say, what do you mean? Hashem has already decided what's going to be, and we know intellectually anyway, if not emotionally, but we know intellectually whatever Hashem does is for the best. So we're davening that Hashem should do something differently. So what do you mean? If he's already decided what he's going to do, isn't that the best? Why would our davening presume to make something better? It's actually making something worse, because Hashem already calibrated what the best path is. So that is a standard question with davening in general. The reason why I feel it's a stronger question here is because with davening in general, the way we usually handle that kind of question of what are we doing with the davening? What do you mean? Hashem's already doing what's best for us. So we can answer that in a few different ways, but they wouldn't apply over here. One way to answer it is that when you daven, you change yourself. So since you change yourself, that also changes what is best for you. So by making ourselves better, then Hashem's the way that Hashem was going to deal with us was the best way possible before we davened, before we made ourselves better people. But once we davened and made ourselves better people, once we davened and connected ourselves to Hashem, so then the best thing for us is now different. That's one approach. That approach only works, though, if you daven for yourself. That approach doesn't work if you're davening for somebody else. Why is it that if there's something that is not good that's happening to me and you daven on my behalf, why should that change things? It's already the best thing for me. So because you daven, that makes you a better person. It doesn't make me a better person. So why does it change what's going to happen to me? So there also, there are several approaches, but one standard approach is that davening is part of the calculation. In other words, what Hashem has determined is that this is the best thing unless somebody davens. But davening in itself is a game changer. Davening gets Hashem to do things differently. That's built in to the whole calculation in the first place. That the right now, the best approach is X, unless there's davening, in which case the best approach is Y. That's already built into the entire thing that Hashem has set up. There are other approaches as well. But I think that typically the reason why we're able to, even if we can't figure out the exact way that davening works, and I'm not sure that anybody could ever figure that out, but I think the reason why we're able to assimilate these answers or similar answers is because we think of davening as when you would plead with a fellow human being. So I'm asking you to help me. You don't want to help me, so I plead. And eventually, you're willing to do it. So that pleading is a way of getting you to feel for me, or maybe increasing our relationship with each other. Something like that. But there's some sort of a cause and effect over there. But here, what happened is that Moshe Rabbeinu said to Hashem, if you destroy them, your reputation is going to be hurt. That's a very calculated thing to say. That's not an emotional thing to say. So where we relate to davening, I think, in an emotional way, even though, of course, Hashem is not emotional, but we are, and we relate to Hashem, we relate to davening in an emotional way, this seems very detached, cold, and calculated. Hashem, it will hurt your reputation. So Hashem already factored that in. What is Moshe Rabbeinu saying that? Why should that change anything? And again, it doesn't feel very good because of how calculated it is. So how do we understand this approach, this davening of Moshe Rabbeinu? So what's important to note is that Hashem created this world in order to give good to human beings, which, without getting into the entire discussion of the Derech Hashem, or the way of God, and how that works, and what giving good means, but ultimately, Hashem wants, so to speak, Kiviyachol, wants to relate to this world, and He wants this world to relate to Him. He wants people to relate to Him. Our job in this world is to be Megala Kvod Shamayim, to bring out, to reveal the honor of heaven. That's our job. Our job is to keep the Torah, and in so doing, we increase Hashem's presence in this world. We increase the connection between people, the world, and Hashem. That's the whole point of existence. That connection between Hashem and this world is with all humanity, all human beings. And when Hashem created the world, it was with those who He created directly, Adam and Chava. But with the subsequent sins, first of Adam and Chava eating from the Eitz Hadas, and then the sins that came afterwards, Cain kills Hevel, and that which we read about in Parashas Bereishis and Noach, and we have the Great Flood, and then we have the Dor HaFlaga, the dispersion. So with each of those sins, the world, or I should say, the relationship of humanity with Hashem changes. Exactly what the nuanced differences were between, not so nuanced actually, before eating from the tree and after eating from the tree, before Cain kills Hevel, after Cain kills Hevel, before the flood and after the flood, before the Haflaga, after the Haflaga. These are discussions that are broader, and we are really reserved for discussing those things directly. But things changed with each iteration of sin and Hashem's relationship with people. Ultimately, what ended up happening is that Hashem separated out one group of people. And that group of people, which is us, because we are descendants of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, we didn't do anything to deserve it. We are descendants of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, which is why we have this privilege. So that Hashem separated out one group of people, and His relationship with the world would be through that group of people. That's it. So then Hashem, from here on in, really from the time of Matan Torah and on, maybe slightly later than that, but approximately then, Hashem's entire relationship with the world is through us, is through the Jewish people. And the rest of the world relates to Hashem also through us. We are the interface between humanity and Hashem, or this world and Hashem. Is it possible for a non-Jew to connect to Hashem? It is possible. Is it possible for a non-Jew to connect to Hashem in the most meaningful way possible without connecting through the Jewish people? No. It's got to be through the Jewish people. It doesn't mean that everybody has to become Jewish, but ultimately the way they're going to connect in the most meaningful way is going to be through us. Whether that means to be taught by us, whether that means to be in our society, whether it means that we are going to bring Hashem's presence into the world by keeping the Torah, making Hashem therefore accessible to the rest of the world perhaps a more indirect way, whatever it means, but the only way for the rest of humanity to connect in a meaningful way to Hashem after the giving of the Torah is through us.
Excuse me, I thought that we're not supposed to teach Goyim about Judaism.
Right, that's correct. But we are supposed
to. We're supposed to teach them.
If they ask, we are to teach them about the mitzvahs that they have to do, the seven mitzvahs.
Oh, not about the question that they asked for, but about what they have to do.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, the question depending on what they ask. If they ask who created the world, I mean, that's an answer we have to give, right? So but that's the way that they connect. So if Hashem is to destroy the Jewish people, what that means is that Hashem is going to destroy His connection to this world. Because He has made it that the way the world can connect with Him is only through the Jewish people. If He destroys the Jewish people, chas v'shalom, without any replacement, then the world ceases to exist. Because the world has no purpose anymore. The only purpose of the world is to connect to Hashem. Otherwise, there is no meaning to existence. The entire universe, not just the universe, even the angels, even the spiritual realm, there is no purpose in any of it other than for humanity to connect to Hashem. And if He is to destroy the Jewish people as He is threatening to do, then not just humanity, but the entire universe, the entire creation has to simply disappear. Hashem didn't say that. Hashem said to Moshe Rabbeinu, I'm going to destroy them and make you into the Jewish people. You are also a descendant of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. So, because it has to come through them, so you will become the new Jewish people. And my connection to the world will no longer be through all of the descendants of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, but rather only through Moshe Rabbeinu and his descendants. Moshe Rabbeinu's response to Hashem, which we learned back in Parshas Kisisa, was that Hashem, if they couldn't make it, as the Jewish people, when they sinned, they were unable to fulfill their purpose in this world, I do not have confidence that my descendants will do any better than they did. Why should my descendants do better than they did? I may have been separated from them, and I didn't stumble and sin with the golden calf, but why should my descendants be any better, any stronger, any more committed? Who says? And therefore, I don't have confidence that that's true. Moshe Rabbeinu's argument to Hashem is, Hashem, if you destroy the Jewish people, and you then, of course, there has to be a replacement, because otherwise the entire existence of the universe, of creation, is meaningless. So you said, what will be that replacement? That will be me and my descendants. But understand, or not understand, of course, that's not the way you talk to Hashem, says Moshe Rabbeinu, however, not only am I not confident that my descendants will do any better, they're going to start behind the eight ball. My descendants are going to start in a world that has already created a narrative that Hashem destroys the people who He appears to love. That Hashem destroys the people who He appears to be connecting to the world through. Because what the Egyptians are going to say is, we thought Hashem loved the Jews. First, we thought Hashem didn't love the Jews when we enslaved them. But then when all those plagues came, and finally He took them out in such a miraculous way, culminating with the death of the firstborn, and then Kriyas Yamsuf. Wow. And then not only that, receiving the Torah. Unbelievable. The Jews, Hashem must really love the Jews. Hashem must really have a connection with the Jewish people. That's what they thought. But then when they see that you're going to destroy them, they're going to rewrite the script. They're going to say, oh, it was all fake, false. It was all fake. It wasn't real. Hashem never loved them. Hashem never felt close to them. Hashem never cared about them. Hashem actually hated them. Umisina so osam. It's because he hated them. He despised the Jews. And that's why he did these miracles. He didn't do miracles out of love for the Jews. He did miracles out of hate for the Jews. He was trying to isolate the Jewish people, get them out of Egypt, where he could then just wipe them out in one fell swoop, in a dramatic death to the entire nation in the wilderness. He hated the Jews. Says Moshe Rabbeinu, now what's going to happen next? My children, you're going to make them the new Jewish people. What's going to be the narrative? People are going to say, them? They're not loved by Hashem. They're hated by Hashem. After all, the last group of people that went through this, that it seemed like Hashem loved them, he actually hated them. And therefore, says Moshe Rabbeinu, if that's the narrative, how is it going to be possible for my children to fulfill the purpose of being the group of people through whom Hashem is revealed in this world? It's one thing if people perceive that you love the Jews. Okay, then the Jews can try to make your presence known in the world. But if people perceive that you hate them, you hate the Jews or the new Jews, who would be my children, then they're going to be very, very, very handicapped in attempting to be Marbek Kavod Shamayim, to bring your honor into this world. So aside from the fact that I don't have confidence that my children will be able to handle all that's thrown at them, just as the Jews didn't handle it, they worshiped the golden calf, I don't have any confidence that my children will do any better than that. When push comes to shove and things get tough, who says they will stand up to the challenges? But even more so, the very purpose of the Jewish people is now undermined. Because now people believe that when you, Hashem, are showing love, you're really showing hate. You don't really love. It's a fake. How on earth are the rest of the world supposed to feel, oh, we want to connect to Hashem, when all they're doing is they're waiting for the other shoe to drop? Yeah, okay, he destroyed the last group. This group he'll destroy too, because he really hates them. That's going to be the narrative. So Moshe Rabbeinu is arguing that Hashem replacing the Jewish people it's not impossible. It's not that you can't. After all, like you're arguing, my children are descendants of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And it's possible that they'll do a better job. But it's a really, really uphill battle. And the narrative that will be spun by the Egyptians will be so detrimental that it will make it an incredibly difficult mountain to scale. And if you save the Jewish people, if you don't destroy the Jewish people, then the opposite is true. Then your love for the Jews will be so evident, so obvious, so clear to the whole world that it will make the purpose of their being a Jewish people, it'll make it something that is viable, something that can be done, something that is meaningful, something that can happen. And so his argument is not like this, Hashem, you're going to hurt your reputation. He's saying the whole purpose, the whole meaning of the universe, the whole meaning of creation is at stake over here. And the most effective way of you, Hashem, that your goal is accomplished, that the world recognizes you, is not by destroying the Jewish people, but rather by forgiving the Jewish people, showing the Jewish people love, so that the narrative that is currently held by the Egyptians, which is Hashem loves those Jews, He did all those miracles for those Jews, that will be reinforced rather than undermined. And that will make it possible for the Jewish people to be Megale Kavod Shamayim, to bring out the honor of heaven and make your presence known in the world. That is appears to be where Moshe Rabbeinu is coming from over here. This approach is borne out by what happens next, which we're going to read about presently, but that Hashem gives the second set of tablets, that Hashem commands that there be a Mishkan built, and even when we commit the sin of the spies, which does condemn everybody to death, but it's not in one fell swoop. It's not in a way that will rewrite the whole narrative of the Exodus from Egypt. It rather, it is over 40 years, the next generation grows up, while it is happening, while the previous generation is dying out, we have the mun, we have the well, we have the clouds. Everything is still functioning in a supernatural, loving way, even as Hashem is punishing the first generation that leaves Egypt, and they're dying out. Nevertheless, the Jews are clearly beloved by Hashem, and therefore it doesn't undermine the job that we are here to do. It does not make it an uphill battle for us to accomplish being Megala Kvod Shammai, bringing out the honor of heaven. So, as we move on now, Perek Yud chapter 10, what happens next? Bo'esahi, at that time, Amar Hashem Elai, Hashem said to me, Psol lecha, Shnei luchos avanim karishonim, chisel or hew for yourself two stone tablets, like the first ones, va'ale elai hahara, and come up to me on the mountain, v'yasi salecha aron eitz, and make for yourself a wooden ark. Or, if you want to be less refined, a wooden box. Because that's what an ark is. It's a box. It's a box in which to put the tablets. So, come up to me on the mountain and make for yourself a wooden box. I ask you, and last time, where was he supposed to put the tablets when he came down the first time? We already see there seems to be a fundamental difference between the first set of tablets and the second set of tablets. The first set of tablets, there was no command to make a utensil in which to hold them. The second set of tablets, there is a commandment to have a box to put them in. Ve'echtov ala luchos es ha-dvarim asher hayu ala luchos ha-rishonim asher shibarta, and I, Hashem, will write on the tablets the words that were on the first set of tablets that you broke. V'samtam ba'aron, and you will place them in the ark. Again, reference to an ark. There was no reference to an ark the first time. Not to make one, not to put the tablets in them. Here, make an ark, place the tablets in them.
Yeah, but the first time, Moshe wouldn't have known the size or what was coming.
So the first time Moshe Rabbeinu wouldn't have known what size.
Told to make an ark.
Okay. He could have been told to build a box of a certain dimension.
Well,
he could have, but you're right. The second time, at least, he has an idea of what it's supposed to be. Okay. It still begs the question of what was he supposed to do with them? We know what he did with them. He broke them. But when he was coming down the mountain with these two huge tablets, what was he supposed to do when he got to the bottom?
Show them off.
Show them, okay, everybody, Vizos HaTorah, right? Here it is. Now what?
Then he could make the ark.
But where are you supposed to put them? There's no ark. There's no Mishkan. Where, what do you do with them?
Put them for all to see.
Where? Put them where?
In his tent, I don't know.
Put them in his tent.
No, the doorway to his tent.
Doorway to his tent. I mean, what, there's no I don't know, edifice is something so special. What do you do with things that are, you don't just put it, what are you supposed to do, put it on the ground? But when we, whenever we have something nice, beautiful, special, we have a beautiful place to put them, right? We put our Sifrei Torah in what we call the Ark. But not just that. You have a diamond. Where does it go? It goes in a setting, right? It goes, anytime you have anything that's beautiful, you place it in something that is going to hold it. That is, and that holder is not as nice as the thing that's holding it, but it enhances its beauty. It also shows that it's special, that's something that deserves something to hold it. What was he supposed to do with those tablets the first time? No mention. But here, clearly, he had to make a box and put the tablets in them. Pasuk Gimel, verse 3. Va'as Aron Atzei Shitim. I made an ark out of cedar wood. Third reference to this ark. Vo'efsol Shnei Luchos Avonim Karishonim. And I hewed two stone tablets like the first ones. Va'al Hahara. I went up to the mountain. Ushnei Luchos Biyadi. And the two tablets were in my hands. I carried them up the mountain. This is also different than the first time. The first time, Moshe Rabbeinu did not hew the stones. Hashem gave him the stones. This time, Moshe Rabbeinu hewed the stones. Vayichtov al luchos kamichtov arishon. Hashem wrote on the tablets like the first writing. Es aseres hadivarim, the aseres hadibros. Asher diber Hashem alechem bahar mitoch ha'esh biyom akahol, that Hashem had spoken to you from the mountain through the fire on the day of the gathering. Vayitneim Hashem Eloi, and Hashem gave those tablets to me, the second set of tablets. Va'if, and I turned. Va'ered minohar, I came down from the mountain. Va'asim es haluchos, and I placed the tablets. Ba'aron asher asisi, in the ark that I made. A fourth reference to this ark. Seems very important. Va'yu sham, and they were there. Kasher tzivani Hashem, like Hashem commanded me. What does that mean? And they were there. Obviously, if you put them in the ark, that's where they are. And they were there. What does that mean? You went home, and there you were. Is that not redundant? If you went home, obviously you're at home. What do you mean, and there you were? So what do you mean? I put them in the ark, and they were there.
But it sounds like they're not there now.
Okay. Okay, see, maybe it means temporarily. Maybe it means temporarily. That I put them in the ark and they were there, meaning not forever, just at that moment they were there. Okay. Okay, it could be. That could be. So, let's understand a little bit about this box that Moshe Rabbeinu put in. First question. Well, we've had a bunch of questions already, but first question is the first direct question here. This box, this Aron, is this the same Aron that appears in the Mishkan with the Kruvim on top? The answer is no. They haven't built the Mishkan yet. The Mishkan, the commandment for the Mishkan takes place after Moshe Rabbeinu comes down from the mountain on Yom Kippur. Then Hashem commands that build a Mishkan. And they build the Mishkan with all the utensils, the Aron, the Menorah, the Shulchan, the two Mizbechos, and they construct it on Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Or I should say they assemble it on Rosh Chodesh Nisan. So the Aron was not built yet when Moshe Rabbeinu came down from the mountain. This Aron is not that Aron. There are two arks. There is this one, and there's the one that was going to be built later by Bezalel when they make the Mishkan. That new ark is not just wood. It has gold on the outside. It has gold on the inside. It has a special covering with Kruvim on top. It has a place to put poles where it's carried on the shoulders of the Levim. It's a special utensil. That's not this box. So then, what is this box? So maybe, Dina, what you said is true. Maybe it's a temporary place. That Vayiusham, they were there, meaning they were there temporarily until the more permanent home for the Luchos would be built. And then they would be transported or transferred from this plain box to the nicer Aron that we made for the Mishkan. So then what happened to this box? Was this box thrown away? What happened to this one after that transfer? Second question. I asked, Moshe Rabbeinu came down from the mountain with the first set of tablets without any instructions about where to put them. Nothing was constructed, nothing was prepared, no instructions where to put them. But it didn't matter because he broke them. What happened to the pieces? So the Gemara tells us, Luchos vishivrei luchos munachos ba'aron. The tablets and the broken tablets are both in the Aron, in the Ark. So does that mean they're both in the main Ark? We'll call it the nice one, the one that's in the Mishkan. So this is a source of debate. There's all kinds of approaches over here. But Rashi tells us clearly, several places in the Chumash, that no, the first set of Luchos, the broken Luchos, were eventually placed in this Ark. There are two Arks. There's the Aron that resides in the Mishkan. That one in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, in the Holy of Holies. Later, of course, was in the Beis HaMikdash, in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. In it is the second set of Luchos, the set of Luchos that are whole and complete, not broken. And that Ark is the Ark that was eventually hidden away by Yoshiyahu HaMelech, by King Yoshiyahu, prior to the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash. That Ark never left the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies, except for one time it was taken out of the Kodesh HaKadoshim. One time. That was in the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, when the Jews went to fight the Plishtim, they took that Ark with them, and that Ark was captured by the Plishtim. By the Plishtim, they ended up having all kinds of disease and sickness because of it, and they eventually sent the Ark back. But that was the only time that it left the Kodesh HaKadoshim. The first set of Luchos, the ones that were broken, were placed in this Ark. I don't know where this Ark was kept, but the first set of Luchos was put in this Ark. When the Jews would go to war, except for that one case, when they fought the Plishtim in the beginning of the book of Shmuel, they took this Ark with them to war. Taking the, we'll call it the nicer Ark, the one that's in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, that they did in the beginning of the book of Shmuel, that was wrong. That was an Avera. They should not have done that. That's why they lost it to the Plishtim. But this Ark, the one that Moshe Rabbeinu builds over here, which eventually will have the first set of Luchos, the broken ones in it, that was appropriate to take to war, and they did. It was used when they took it to war, when they went to war. It led them. So that's what will happen to this box. It's not going to get thrown away. It will be the place where the first set of Luchos, the broken ones, will be kept. So I go back to my question from before. Where were the broken Luchos now? There is no box yet. Moshe Rabbeinu builds this new box, plain box, takes it upstairs, puts the second set of Luchos in it, brings that downstairs, waits almost 6 months until they put up the Mishkan, and then the Luchos are transferred from this box into the nicer one. And at that time, the broken Luchos are placed into this box. Where are the broken Luchos until now? So the answer is, I don't know. I don't know where the broken Luchos were kept. But that is immaterial to the point we're trying to make. The point we're trying to make is that the first set of luchos had no place. There was no place to put them, and that was deliberate. There was no place to put them when Moshe Rabbeinu came down the mountain. There was no place to put them when he broke them. I don't know where they were kept, but there was no place to put them. Why not? Because the first version of getting the Torah before we committed the sin of the golden calf was meant to be that the Torah was not in a box, in a very holy place that no one could go into except on Yom Kippur and only if you're the Kohen Gadol. Rather, it was meant to be that those luchos were everywhere. Everybody had access to them. Now, what that means, I don't know. Meaning, I don't know where they would be. Well, maybe they would hover in midair, for all I know. I have no idea. But it doesn't matter. The point is, whatever that plan was, it was not going to be that they would be hidden away. They would be out in the open for all to see. That's what they were supposed to be. When they were broken, they still remained out in the open for all to see. They were not put away into a box until the construction of the Mishkan. That's when they were put in a box. Even then, they were not squirreled away in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies. Rather, they were used when we went to war. But that's when they were put in a box. The second set of luchos were never meant to be that way. The second set of luchos, from their inception, as Hashem emphasizes to Moshe Rabbeinu, and it's repeated here four times, they are to be placed in a box. Don't even come up the mountain without a box, says Hashem. Bring that box with you. Don't come up here for that second set of luchos without a place to put them. Because this is not like the first set. The second set will be put away in a box. It's not for all to see whenever they want. They're going to be put away in a box. And the second set of luchos were placed in that box, hidden away, until the Mishkan was constructed, and then they were placed in the new, more beautiful Aron, and then this box was used for the first set of luchos. Why is this? Why is it that the second set of luchos was now going to be hidden away? There's much written about this. I'm only going to share a few things. First of all, we know that the giving of the Torah the first time on Shavuos was with all kinds of fanfare. Lightning and thunder, fire. It was a terrifying experience. It was Hashem's revelation on the mountain. The second set of luchos was much quieter. Moshe Rabbeinu came down the mountain with a box. In that box was two sets. It was the second set of tablets. That's all. No fanfare. No fire and lightning. No thunder. Just Moshe Rabbeinu comes down the mountain with this box. In the box are the tablets. Rashi says that even though the giving of the Torah is, without question, the most impactful thing to happen since the creation of the world, nothing is as important as the giving of the Torah. After all, even at creation itself, the pasuk says, "Vayihi erev, vayivoker yom hashishi," that it was the sixth day. Chazal tell us the world was hanging in the balance until the sixth day of Sivan, when the Torah would be given. And if the Jews would accept the Torah, then the world could continue to exist, and otherwise it would disappear in the blink of an eye. The giving of the Torah was the most significant event in the history of the world, and it was Hashem's most open revelation ever. Nevertheless, the second set of luchos was even better, because, Ein lecha yafeh minatznius. There is nothing more beautiful than modesty. And the second set of luchos being given quietly, without fanfare, in a box, nobody saw it. Moshe Rabbeinu just comes down the mountain. That has a beauty that transcends the fanfare, the pomp and circumstance of the first set of luchos. That's one point. The second set of luchos represents the mida, the character trait of tznius, of modesty. And therefore, they're always hidden away. They're in a box. And even when, and then later when they're transferred from one box to the other, they still remain in a box. And they remain in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies. There is more to say. It seems that when the Torah was given to us the first time, the ability to learn and understand and assimilate what the Torah says was a lot easier than it is today. When we first got the Torah, it was something that was relatively easy to absorb, to understand, to become a part of, to become attached to. When we sinned with the golden calf and we distanced ourselves from Hashem, it meant that our ability to understand the Torah, absorb the Torah, connect to the Torah, became more difficult. The second set of luchos represents that difficulty. The first set of luchos was open, available, out there. Anybody could come and see it. I don't know where, I don't know how, but it was out there. No box, no Kodesh HaKadoshim. But the second set of luchos, it's in a box. It's in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. You can't go in there unless you're the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur. It's put away. If you want that Torah, you got to work your head off to get it. You got to work hard. You got to sweat, toil, fight. You got to make it a mission to get that Torah. And that is representative of the second set of luchos, where the first set of luchos are totally different than that. So we see that here emphasizing this box. I want to mention, only because it's relevant to this point, although it is a slight digression, that when we learned the book of Daniel, we pointed out then that when the hand wrote on the wall, when Belshazzar, the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar, made his party to celebrate the fact that the 70 years of the exile of Babel that had been predicted that the Jews would be redeemed, the 70 years were over and the Jews were not redeemed, and he was celebrating, and he took out the utensils of the Beis HaMikdash and celebrated using those utensils, and a hand came down and wrote on the wall, terrifying everybody. And that night, Belshazzar was attacked by the alliance of the Persian and the Medes, and they totally destroyed the army of Belshazzar and executed Belshazzar. And Babel, the Babylonians, lost their hold over the power of the world. It now moved from Babel, the seat of power, to the Persians and Medes. When that happened, everybody was terrified. A hand wrote on the wall. But what compounded their fear was no one could understand what it said. It was written in code. No one could understand it. Only Daniel was able to understand it. The Gemara in Maseches Sanhedrin has various approaches to what it said and what the code was. We have a few different possibilities of what it said. Well, we know what it said, but how it interpreted to what it meant. And what was the code that was used. And the Gemara goes through it. and only Daniel knew it. One approach in the Gemara is that the reason why no one could read it, even though there were Jews in the room, not just Daniel, is because it was written in a Hebrew script that people were unfamiliar with. And that is Ksav Ashuris. That's the block lettering with which we write a Sefer Torah today. If you look in a Sefer Torah today, it's written with that special block lettering called Ksav Ashuris. Until then, the Jews were unfamiliar with Ksav Ashuris. They were familiar with a different script. It was Aleph Beis, but a different script called Ksav Ivris, which is somewhat similar to a script version of Hebrew. That's what they were familiar with. Only the great Talmidei Chachamim, the great Nevi'im, only they knew Ksav Ashuris. Daniel, who was the heir to prophecy, he was the leader of the Jews in Golus, in exile, he knew Ksav Ashuris. No one else did. And that's why he was able to interpret what it said. After the second Beis HaMikdash was constructed, Ezra HaSofer, he's called the Sofer, the scribe, Ezra, who was the greatest Talmud Chacham of his generation, he instituted that from then on the Jews would use Ksav Ashuris, which is what we use today. Ezra is the one who instituted that. But before then, the Jews, by and large, rank and file, were unfamiliar with Ksav Ashuris. One approach is that the second set of Luchos was written with Ksav Ashuris, but it was hidden away. No one could see it, and therefore no one could learn it. There were the great Talmidei Chacham, of course, Moshe Rabbeinu, Yehoshua, the big ones, the leadership knew it, and they also transmitted it to the next set of leaders. You had to have reached a certain level of scholarship that only a few attained in any generation to be taught Ksav Ashuris. And Daniel knew it, others didn't. And then Ezra made it that would be the standard script. When we learned the book of Ezra, we discussed possibilities why it then became the mainstream script after the construction of the second Beis HaMikdash, having to do with the loss of prophecy and now the age of Torah, meaning that once we hit the second Beis HaMikdash, we lose prophecy, then the only thing that really holds us is the Torah. We needed a bump. We needed some improvement, some way of relating to the Torah that would give us more, more help in relating to the Torah that we didn't have before. We discussed that when we learned the book of Ezra. Be that as it may, the second set of Luchos also represents this point, that the Ksav Ashuris was hidden away. That's the point I was making before, how the Torah was more difficult to access. You had to really work hard to develop that scholarship once we had the second set of Luchos. So Moshe Rabbeinu comes down the mountain with this box. In the box is the second set of Luchos. That's where they remain, meaning they're not out in the open. That's what the Torah is emphasizing. They're in the box, not for all to see. Later, when they get transferred from that box to the nicer box, to the Aron that goes into the Kodesh HaKadoshim, then the first set of Luchos, the broken ones, were placed into this box, and that was used for when we went to war. We did not cover the third bullet point I sent in the email today. We didn't get to the relationship of the Levium and Hashem forgiving the Jews. And the death of the Tzaddik. We didn't discuss that. So we will lead off next time, Yirtzeh Hashem, with Pasuk Vav, verse 6 in Perek Yud, chapter 10. And we'll lead off with that point about the death of Tzaddikim and the relationship of the tribe of Levi and the Jewish people.